I always have a backup.
Two of them?
Yeah. I don't want to miss an interview because batteries run out or...
So how'd you come to want to contact me?
Well, we've known about you for some time. And we've talked to a lot of people at GI.
Uh-huh, okay.
And we've been conducting, we're closing in on 200 interviews with people in the biotech industry on the notion that what's happened over the past 40 years is going to be really important for humanity in the future. So,
well, it has been already. Will continue to be.
Right, that's right. So nobody's actually recorded the real history yet, so we're doing it.
Is this going to be a book?
Yeah, we're working on a book on the origins of the biotech industry in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So the GI period, certainly, and you're doing stuff well in advance of that. Maybe we could get started with a little bit of biographical background, where you're from, where'd you grow up, your family background.
Okay, I was born in Brooklyn, raised in Queens, in a little community called Laurelton, just by the Kennedy Airport, or as it was called, Idlewild in those days.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I went to public school. Then I left New York, went to Amherst College, which was something entirely different from my upbringing.
Right, so you're coming from a middle class, working class background?
Middle class.
Yeah, and what did your parents do?
My father was a stockbroker.
Uh-huh, okay.
My mother was a frustrated author homekeeper.
Uh-huh, okay. And you must have been a good student, yeah?
Yeah.
And you from interested in the sciences from the beginning?
From an early age.
Mm-hmm.
I think my junior high school biology teacher, whose name was something like Mrs. Iskowitz. She was short and pretty and very lively. And probably got me excited about biology.
So,
but I started, I worked in labs washing pipettes when I was 12 or something like that.
How did that come about?
Connections of my father, I don't know what the...
Was he working with healthcare companies or?
At the, somebody you knew.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So, companies in Queens?
No.
Like lab testing or?
No, it was in Manhattan.
Uh huh.
And New York had a pretty good enrichment program for kids interested in science. Because I didn't go to one of the exam schools, I went to just a big public high school.
Mm-hmm.
Southeastern Queens is too far from Bronx Science, that's 90 minutes each way.
Yeah.
By subway. So I used to go to Columbia on weekends. They had a biology enrichment course with some people who turned out to be fairly famous later on when they were younger. And I never understood a word of what they said.
Yeah, do you remember the names? Who?
Yeah, there was this guy named Lewontin.
Richard Lewontin, the guy at Harvard.
Yeah,
I think so. Who's doing, he's still...
Yeah, he's
in race and
population geneticist.
Yeah,
he was must have been a graduate student. I don't know, but he was lecturing these high school kids and covering the blackboard with incomprehensible stuff. But he was very excited.
And through high school, then you're thinking, I'll go to college and study this, or?
I think I probably decided quite young. I don't know when. And I wanted to go to a small college, so I picked Amherst. The catalog was purple. I think I liked the color. And we didn't get much advice about where to go.
At your high school? Yeah. Turned out to be a good choice?
It was a good choice. Great place. And I had the grades to get in, so I got in there. And Amherst is a wonderful place. So a lot of individual attention and I majored in biophysics to avoid all the pre-meds, since I knew I wanted to be a scientist, not a doctor.
They weren't clued into molecular biology at that point.
Molecular biology hardly existed. This was 1961.
Well, biophysics is sort of one of the precursors, yeah.
Well, it wasn't really biophysics. The biology department was all pre-meds, and if you wanted to avoid that, you majored in biophysics and you got straight science. no bio. I don't think they knew what biophysics was, but what they meant was biology, chemistry, math, and physics.
Okay.
So I had to take courses in all of those, which was pretty rough.
But also pretty valuable, yeah?
Very valuable, very valuable. I've forgotten almost all of it. But it became difficult during your senior year because, you know, I'd be taking a few physics courses, and the physics major was taking all physics courses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was pretty challenging.
Yeah. And you never had any notion of becoming a doctor? I think that's something that's common to a lot of people.
No, I didn't want to do medicine. Yeah,
just science.
No, just science. Mm-hmm. But the biophysics department had 6 full professors and 3 students. And so we had seminar courses in professors' homes. And you know, Amherst still is and then was a really great place where students were really encouraged to be creative and to learn a lot. So, you know, we didn't learn from textbooks. At these seminars, we had to present papers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I remember reading the first edition of the Journal of Molecular Biology, and I guess I had to present the Jacobin-Lano paper on gene regulation.
Okay, it's a good place to start. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But my real connection with serious science came by accident. So I was working as an assistant for a geneticist counting fruit flies. I found that was kind of boring. And in the early 60s, bacterial genetics was the buzzword. This is the hot thing to do. And that wasn't available at Amherst. They had no modern biology, really, mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do an NSF summer course, which I saw advertised on a bulletin board. And they were offering a studentship in bacterial genetics, which I saw. I still remember that. It was a bulletin board. Mm-hmm. It said bacterial genetics. So I got excited. The downside, it was in Cleveland, Ohio, which wasn't really where I wanted to spend summer.
Right.
And it gave the name of the person whose lab this would be in. Meant nothing to me. I didn't know anyone, mm-hmm. in science. So it ended up, I spent 2 summers in the lab of a woman named Harriet Afrusi Taylor.
Afrusi, that,
yeah,
related to
Boris's. Okay. So you know your history.
Yeah.
So Boris and Harriet had blown out of France. Boris was running modern French science and had a big dispute with the government, and he got angry. He got angry often. He was a Russian. And they took this job in Cleveland when Needleman, I think, who subsequently went to Searle, he's the father of Celebrex, great pharmacologist. Mm-hmm. So he was in Cleveland. He was trying to get faculty, and he had a little building which he gave to Boris to kind of get him to come to the U.S.
Right.
And they spent, I think, 3 years in the U.S. and they went back to France.
Mm-hmm.
All forgiven.
Yeah.
So I was lucky enough to work with Harriet Afrusi. She was Avery's student, probably Avery's best student.
Mm.
And so she worked on pneumococcal transformation.
She was there for those experiments?
Yeah. Well,
maybe not. Yeah.
Avery's great work was in the 40s, right?
Late 40s,
I think. Yeah, she was probably there. Yeah. So she was working on pneumococcal transformation, and so I did some experiments in pneumococcal transformation,
mm-hmm.
and got to know. After the second year, I stopped shaking in my boots when Boris came around. He was pretty. Pretty emotional
character,
guy.
Yeah,
but very, very impressive man, brilliant guy. And I got to know them personally. We used to house sit their cats. And my connection with sort of the mainstream came through them. So I don't know if you know the history that. So Boris and Max Delbruck were best friends. And Max Delbruck was the guy who started the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And when the Afrusis lived in France in the 50s. They had a farm, and Harriet was a good cook, and she's a very impressive Boston Brahmin lady, brilliant, just competent lady. Also a great cook, great French cook.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this young kid, Jim Watson, used to come and hang out on their farm to be fed by Harriet.
In France,
yeah. This is 54 or something like that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So anyway, the reason I'm telling that story is that my last summer there, was between my junior and senior year in college, I had been living in the Frusey's house in Shaker Heights, Cleveland, had a big old house with a garden, sitting there, Siamese cat. And the Frusey's came back from a vacation and were having tea in their living room. And I asked Boris where I should go to graduate school, thinking he would know where to go to graduate school. And he said, go to Caltech.
That's where Delbrook was.
That's where Delbrook was. And I said something stupid like, they have smog there.
Which is true.
Which is true. And I'll never forget, he then said, well, you'll have to go work with Jim then. Harriet, arrange it. So the next day I come to the lab and I ask Harriet, who's Jim? I had no idea what he was talking about. And then she said, Jim Watson. And I said, isn't he dead? You know, he already had the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
He's an old guy.
Wasn't that old at that point? Was he still
So she wrote me an amazing letter of recommendation. So I got into the Watson-Gilbert lab and discovered many years later that Jim had been afraid of me all the time I was there, because he would never think of not doing what Harriet instructed him to do. And she wrote this really strong letter.
So she, a very forceful, a pair of forceful personalities.
Yeah, charming too, but they were quite something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So during that period, you're in college, you're set then on a career in science, an academic career. That's your idea going forward.
Yeah.
And so you're asking, where's the best place to go? Well, those are the two top choices, yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, in the Watson-Gilbert lab in the... So I went there in 65, which was kind of the peak of the strength of that lab before Jim went to Cold Spring Harbor. And it was a great place. I think there are three of my peers there got Nobel Prizes since the time.
Who was there?
Oh,
Gilbert was there.
Mark Gilbert was co-running the lab. And Mario Capecchi taught me biochemistry. He was there. And I was succeeded by Bob, what's his name, Horvitz. We overlapped just for about 6 months. And it was an amazing place.
Yeah.
Discoveries were going on. You know, Watson and Gilbert weren't the nicest of people to train with.
Well, say a bit about that. What was your experience when you arrived? You have to sort of get acclimated to the place. Was it different than the labs you'd been in before?
Well, I arrived and had a brief discussion with Jim, very, very brief. And he told me that I would be working with a guy named John Tooze, and then he turned around and walked away. So I had to go up and down the corridor trying to find out who was John Tooze. I don't know if you know John Tooze.
No.
So he's, John went on to be, he was the first editor of Nature New Biology, and he's published lots of books, and he's published a lot of stuff with Cold Spring Harbor. He was a bench scientist there, and he wasn't much of a bench scientist.
No.
But a very interesting British character. So in the Watson lab, you had to find your own way.
Yeah.
Jim didn't really talk to his students very often.
How did that suit you? Was it?
It was fine.
Yeah,
I was happy being independent.
Yeah.
But and there were a lot of he expected people to train other people, just sort of expected it all to happen, and he would provide. General direction and special kind of enthusiasm. I mean, he knew he was great and he expected everyone working with him would be great. And you were expected to make a discovery and, you know, probably get a Nobel Prize. That was sort of...
So did you feel you had greatness in you at that point?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
But enough confidence that you could do something good to stick around?
Yeah, I think a certain degree of arrogance was encouraged. And so Jim's interaction with people was a tea. He, you know, he's still a great Anglophile. I think he has a house in London. So we all got together for tea at 4 o'clock, and that's when people talked. And then there were noon seminars, which were often abuse sessions. They were really rough.
So you'd present your work and everybody would rip it apart. And
yeah, particularly Jim Molly and Mark Potashny. And questioning was pretty direct.
Mm-hmm.
So I got well trained in asking pointed questions.
Yeah.
But, you know, people survived.
Sure. What did you start working on and how did you get into it? I mean, you're making connections in the lab.
Well, the lab was largely an RNA phage lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the in the days before recombinant DNA, the model system was bacteriophage. But you probably know the phage group history. Mm-hmm. This is Delbruck's mm-hmm. physicist approach to
right.
biology work with something that's simple. So a lot of the work in Jim's lab was working on RNA bacteriophage.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working on a phage called R17 and got interested, I won't go through the whole history, and so this was the first in vitro replicating biologic system. You could in an in vitro system, you could replicate the RNA phage RNA and make infectious RNA, which you could then mm-hmm. infect back into bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite interesting to work on the enzymology of that. So my thesis project ended up being purifying for the first time the phage enzyme, which was responsible for replicating RNA.
What specifically, how did it work?
Oh, I can just say, a review was just published. It just got yeah. figured out. It's complicated.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
But so Jim's lab worked on a phage called R17. In order to do what I wanted to do, I had to switch to a rival phage that his lab had never worked on. So that was,
mm-hmm.
took a confrontation with Jim, but he went along with it. And I had to set up a collaboration with one of his big competitors that he didn't get along with too well.
Who was that?
Saul Spiegelman.
Uh-huh, yeah.
One of the greats.
He was in New York too, in New York, yeah.
Well, he was in Illinois at that time, then he moved to New York.
I see.
And he didn't get along with Watson Lab too much.
Mm-hmm. So he really he didn't want you to do it. How did you persuade him?
No, he didn't oppose it.
Yeah.
It just was...
You had to make a case for it.
Yeah, I made a case and it was fine.
Yeah.
So I ended up purifying this enzyme, which turned out to be extremely interesting. It was a precedent. The enzyme had four polypeptide subunits. This was the early days of SDS gels. You know, you could really purify a mm-hmm. protein, look on a gel and see what it was. It had just been, SDS gels were developed in Jim's lab.
Mm-hmm.
So people were just doing that.
Who did that?
It was Weber and Osborne, Klaus Weber and Mary Osborne,
mm-hmm.
your postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
Klaus then became a Harvard faculty and moved back to Germany, and he's a great in German science.
Mm-hmm.
So the curious thing, there were four subunits, but the viral genome wasn't big enough to encode those four subunits, and it also encoded other proteins. So I figured out, with advice of a postdoc in the lab, how to do an experiment which would prove that it was a interspecific hybrid enzyme, that there was only one polypeptide chain from the virus, and it was co-opting three host proteins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I showed that with an appropriate experiment and then showed that, took the enzyme apart, put it back together again. I showed that the host proteins, the E. coli proteins, were required for the activity.
Had anything like that been discovered before?
No.
So that's a pretty big deal, yeah.
Yeah, so that became a Nature paper. And I had a major competitor working on Q-beta replicase who was the great scientist of the field, Charles Weissman. And Charles was sort of a friend of the Watson-Gilbert lab because he was in a big war with Spiegelman about how replicase worked mechanistically, and the only people that really supported him were Jim and Wally.
Mm-hmm.
They recognized he was brilliant and
uh-huh.
infallible. So he came to visit, but he disagreed about the structure of the enzyme.
Your enzyme?
Yeah, well, he'd also purified it about uh-huh. the same time. And he wasn't convinced. He thought these other polypeptide chains were contaminants.
Mm-hmm.
So he came to visit one weekend, and I think it was Wally Gilbert and I worked on Charles in the corridor at a blackboard. And I won't go through the details. He had a rational reason why
mm-hmm.
he thought there were contaminants. We convinced him that I was right. And then at the end of that, he mentioned that, well, he had a paper that had been accepted in Nature, and maybe he changed a bit. So we ended up publishing back-to-back, and he changed his story to a degree. Mm-hmm. But the big advantage of working for Jim, I don't know if you know this, but Jim never put his name on a paper of anyone coming out of his lab. I think there's one Cold Spring Harbor symposium, big review, with everybody's name. Mm-hmm. Jim's name is there. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, all this great work was being done, and he never put his name on a paper.
He didn't need it, right?
Well, you know, he had a special kind of beneficent arrogance, I would say. Mm-hmm. In his point of view, anyone who he cared about knew who his students were anyway.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. But I think I learned later, he copied some friends. This is MRC Cambridge. Francis Crick would never have put his name on a student's paper, and it wasn't the custom at MRC Cambridge to mm-hmm. big professors. The professors did experiments, and
yeah.
the students were talked to now and then, but
yeah.
you didn't sign their papers. So that was a big advantage. Yeah. And also, Jim didn't like speaking at meetings, which he doesn't do very well. At least at that time, he did very badly. He mumbled and he was a bit too shy, I think, to speak publicly. So he would sort of appear in your lab at 11 o'clock at night. The lab went to 4 in the morning. People really worked hard. Mm-hmm. And he'd sort of walk around 11 midnight, stick his head in, rarely spoke, just stare at you. Mm-hmm. It was very disconcerting. And he really wanted to hear Eureka. You know, he wanted to hear you did something exciting. Mm-hmm. And if you had that sort of conversation, this is vague memories now, he'd come and plunk himself down in a lab stool and go like that and stare at you. He wanted to hear the story. And if it was something really kind of interesting, he'd say something like, you know, I've been invited to give a talk at a meeting next month. I don't want to do that. Why don't you do it? So the next day you talk to the secretary, what's this meeting? What's it up? And, you know, it's a plenary lecture. So it's a symposium. And you're a third year graduate student. And it's a way he's tightening the screws because he figured you'd really work hard, mm-hmm. get the story finished. Yeah. But it was good training.
Yeah, yeah. So this is all going well.
Yes.
Did you have any sort of obstacles or setbacks along the way? Or things
out? No, work didn't always go. It was up and down. Mm-hmm. The Cubator replicate stuff, that went well. But before that, I was kind of in limbo, lost a couple of times. Mm-hmm. While it was... I don't know if you know these characters. Have you met
Jim? I've met Jim Watson, Wally Gilbert.
Yeah.
Haven't met Mark Potashny.
No. Yeah, well, Wally was the shoulder I used to cry on, if you could believe that.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Literally, no, Jim is a tough guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He fired me once.
Did he? What did you do?
Didn't smile enough.
Is it?
I was probably grim. Probably too serious, too grim.
Well, it's a serious place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know, but he forgave me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're observing what other people are doing there. They're doing great things, right?
Yeah.
What was Gilbert doing at that time? This is...
Gilbert was purifying the LAC repressor with Benamila Hill, you know, which is the work he really got the Nobel Prize for. Mm-hmm. DNA sequencing was, I think, an excuse to hang it on. Mm-hmm. You know, one little amusing story. That was sort of the great days of early molecular biology, in which there was, at least Jim had unlimited money. He had no problem with grants. So the graduate students stayed 4 years and then 5 years because of the war. Jim would never let somebody leave and get drafted, so mm-hmm. he found money to mm-hmm. keep people until they were over 26. So he had to, you know, do your... Yeah. At that point, they weren't drafting people mm-hmm. past 26, so
it's
everybody in Jim's
yeah.
lab stayed on. He didn't want to send anybody to mm-hmm. fight the war.
He was opposed to on principle?
Yeah, yeah, very strongly. So the last year, the graduate students had technicians, if you can believe that, and you were allowed to hire your own technician. Hmm. So I hired this guy named Alan Maxim, had dropped out of a PhD program at Brandeis for some emotional crisis. I never could pin it down, but he was a, mm-hmm. a bit of a special kind of character. So his hands got me through my PhD work.
He's good.
He's
good,
really
experimentalist.
Good. Yeah, really good. Fantastic. And mm-hmm. super organized. Great guy. And when I left, Alan went to work for Wally. And Alan's the guy who figured out how to sequence DNA.
Sure.
So all these wonderful detailed protocols that went around the world. And Wally had the idea, but and Wally was a great experimentalist with his hands, but he wasn't working in the lab enough to do something like that. But Alan really made a huge contribution by working that out. So my contribution was bringing Alan into the lab.
And Potashny at the same time is working, he was working...
They were working on Lambda Repressor, competing with Wally. They were fierce rivals and good friends.
That must have been an interesting mix.
It was very interesting.
But there's a good introduction to science, the top...
Yeah, it was a very exciting place. And there were some... Joan Stites was there, great person.
And she could mix it up with the rest.
Oh, yes. Well, Jib is always partial to women. And
made it a little easier for her to do.
She was one of the few people in the lab that seemed to be a close friend of his. They were.
I see.
They got along very well. They communicated well. Jim tended to triangulate. He didn't talk to student A about what student A was doing, but he knew. Even if you never told him, he knew exactly what you were doing. Because Jim has complete photographic, he doesn't forget anything. Or at least at that time he didn't.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly what was going on, but he didn't you didn't have a lab meeting with him and tell him what you were doing. He figured it out.
Yeah.
Detail by detail.
So you work on your dissertation, you're moving that forward, and what was your plan for... end up.
So the custom in that lab, you did well, you left Jim's lab and you went to Cambridge. That's what most people did. And I was always a bit of an iconoclast, and I didn't really want to follow what everyone else did. And there was another student, Volker Vogt, who was a German name, but he was American of German heritage. And he decided he was going to go to Switzerland, which in the end he didn't end up doing. I can't remember why.
He was going to go to Weizmann's place.
I don't remember where he was going to go, but he was going to go somewhere, either Germany or Switzerland, I remember. So I'd gotten to know Charles over this competition, and asked Charles if I could go to his lab to continue working on Q-beta. And he thought that was a great idea, and so he invited me to come combine forces and work with him.
And was his lab, the way he ran it, much different than Watson's?
Very different. All the key lab reagents were kept in a locked freezer, and only Charles had the key. And you have to ask Charles for small aliquots to do experiments, and he also counted the lambda pipettes, the micro pipettes, and you had to keep your set together and turn in the broken one to get a new one.
Is this because of budget constraints there that Watson have?
No, very, very different personality. Charles was, on top of the detail of every experiment. Also a super strong personality. But I got along with Charles great. I loved him.
And what was, in particular, he brought you into, what was the plan you were going to?
Well, I don't think my postdoc was particularly successful with him. I continued to do some work on Q-beta replicates, but it wasn't so good. But I learned a lot from the lab, and it was helpful for me because he was in the transition from, that was sort of the beginning of recombinant DNA. So he was sort of exiting the work on the RNA phage. He'd gotten into retroviruses. So half the lab worked on RNA retroviruses. And he had a very rigorous journal club that met twice a week where we actually read the whole scientific literature he assigned people. And I learned a huge amount about all sorts of, about animal viruses, all sorts of things I knew nothing about.
So you mentioned recombinant DNA, you read about Berg's.
That was all going on, and my successor in the lab, we overlapped by about 6 months with Richard Favell. We shared an apartment and we've been friends ever since.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Richard was involved in the early interferon cloning stuff. And so probably about, when was that? I left in 71. Well, some years later, they cloned the first interferon messenger. It must have been 79. Well, it was a while later.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to continue with the biography, so when I finished up in Charles's lab, I decided that I wanted to work on animal viruses. I was following the Delbruckian accident.
Yes.
We sort of done RNA phage.
Mm-hmm.
All the questions left, I thought, were derivatives. That turned out not to be true. Yeah, but
I felt a lot of people were going in this direction.
Yeah, so I went to Cold Spring Harbor, took the Cold Spring Harbor Animal Virus course. Got really interested in animal viruses.
Who taught that course?
Aaron Shatkin and Bill Cates, with a little help from this guy named Art Levinson, who was a Cates's PhD student, I think. Hmm. No, John, he was kind of like the TA in the course.
Mm-hmm.
Our story. My
very small world.
My image of him is this guy in a white T-shirt and sneakers without socks and jeans, running around like a rabbit all the time, always intense and energized. So I wanted to do a second postdoc in animal virus work. But at that time, the animal virus labs were large labs run by rather controlling individuals. The field was just starting. There were a couple of big labs at NCI. There was a big lab in St. Louis. It wasn't, there weren't tons of them. And I wasn't at a point in my career where I wanted to go and work for somebody. I wanted a lab that had facilities and I could do my thing.
Did you have a plan at that point? You wanted to do something and get somewhere? You wanted to get back to the States?
No, I wanted to work on gene expression and DNA tumor viruses.
And do what you wanted to do rather than what somebody else wanted to do.
Yeah. I didn't know more than that. I'm not even sure I really wanted to work on DNA tumor viruses. I wanted to work on tumor viruses, and I wanted to figure out how genes worked. And fortunately, I remember this wonderful man, Lionel Crawford, who was another Jim friend who used to come and hang around the lab in Cambridge in summers, I think. I don't know. He was a really nice man and very smart, but not known for being overbearing. So I wrote Lionel, and he was at Imperial Cancer Research Labs in London. So I wrote Lionel a letter and asked if I could come and join him, and he wrote back right away saying, sure, come. We've got space for you. And that was just wonderful. So during the 70s, from 71 till 82, I was at ICRF on the famous fifth floor of ICRF, which was an unbelievable thing that Lionel had built and a few other people.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the people who, until a few years ago, ran molecular oncology in the U.S. were there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was close connection with Cold Spring Harbor, so Phil Sharp was coming over, Joe Sandberg was coming over. Shared a lab with Frank McCormick and Tony Pawson, and they discovered P53 while we were there.
Mm.
Bruce Ponder was there, or he was Lionel's student. It was an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm. And so, what was your status there for those?
Well, initially I came as a postdoctoral fellow, but Lionel just provided facilities. He just didn't. This is pretty much the British amateur tradition. He had a technician and a student, and he worked at the bench and did his work, and he provided core facilities, really very good core facilities. It was a wonderfully set up lab. The whole institute was beautifully set up.
Yeah.
And they paid for everything. There were no grants, no money, didn't apply for anything.
This is heaven, yeah?
Yeah, it's like working at the NIH, but on a smaller scale. There was a storeroom. You went and got supplies from the storeroom and signed your name. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was there for a couple of years as a postdoc, and then I came back to the States and did my job hunting tour. Jack Strominger hired me to be one of the first employees at Dana-Farber when Dana-Farber was expanding and going into basic science. That was 76, I think. I would have shared a lab module with Bill Hazeltine, who was I also shared a lab with in Jim's lab.
Oh.
Bill was Wally's student, so we knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been a disaster sharing with Bill. But
why do you say that?
Well, he's
another strong personality.
A little bit. I don't know if you know Hazeltine.
Yeah, I met him.
Yeah. Character.
Mm-hmm.
He's a friend. I like him, but he's a character. If you want to get into real life, he comes back into my histories much later. So I got this job at Dana-Farber. I wrote a grant with David Livingston. We became very close friends. And the grant was approved, fully funded. And then I had kind of my 3 months before exit interview with Michael Stoker, who was the wonderful man that had revolutionized ICRF. And I told Michael I was leaving, and he said in a polite way, you know, you don't really want to do that. Why don't you just stay? We'll give you tenure. Just hang out here. He didn't say hang out here, but, you know, he just said, just stay. And I thought that sounded pretty wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I go through the whole U.S. system when I could stay there and not apply for grants?
Yeah, did you like living in London?
Yeah, I love living in London.
Yeah. It's a little more affordable than
it is. So I just basically carried on. My title changed. I was no longer postdoc. I was the head of a lab. My lab got a name. It was the transcription lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I could take graduate students and postdocs. And so.
And how did the position work? I mean, you're subject to review on some
quinquennial reviews they had.
Mm-hmm.
Every 5 years you got reviewed by three outside folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're looking ahead saying, this is fine, I'll do this for...
Yeah, so I did that for 6 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was getting a bit frustrated because the limit, something has to be limiting, and what was limiting there was space.
Mm.
I had two lab bays, say two, you know, a lab bay is about the size of this room. I had two of these, that was the space, plus a shared instrument room, and 13 people.
Okay, yeah.
It was pretty crowded.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit frustrating, you know, you really couldn't grow
right,
the lab.
Right.
And I felt incorrectly that we couldn't compete with the big American labs. But as I said, the people from there mostly moved back to the States and became the big American labs.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a misperception.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly the problem that sort of got me was lab turnover. I was still working at the bench. I loved doing experiments. I was very close to my students. And then they leave, and new students would come in, and they were younger. They seemed to be younger. So it was on my third turnover, and thinking, I just didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't like writing papers. I liked doing science, but I didn't like publishing and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But those are minor things. But, the biotech industry was starting.
Yeah, well, I guess began 76, so while you're there, it is. Are you paying any attention to it?
I come back to the States occasionally. I remember a lunch I had with Wally where he told me that he and Charles were going to start a company.
Mm-hmm. What did he say?
Well, he thought it would be a good way to provide jobs for postdocs.
That was the principal.
And that's what I remember.
I
don't know what he said, but.
Yeah, well, the words, I mean, he did have some problems at Harvard, right? With
Wally? No, I don't think so. He had problems getting tenure.
Well, I mean, he had he wanted to be an officer in the company, and they wouldn't let him. He had to
after that, I was sort of on the outside. I knew what Charles was up to, and and so it was kind of interesting. It seemed exciting.
And what did you think about the business angle of it, where, you know, you people are investing money, and you have to give them returns on that? Did that ever enter into the...
No, I don't think so.
Not at that point, yeah?
No, it was just sort of an exciting new thing of, you know, using what we knew to make drugs and do something practical.
Yeah.
I don't even think it wasn't just focused on making drugs. There were all these, you know, biomass projects, all these crazy things. It was applying recombinant DNA.
Right.
And I found that somewhat attractive. No, it wasn't, you know, that I really went out to do that. It happened like most things that happen in life, accidentally. So Wally and Charles got going with Biogen, and I don't know if you know their history of Biogen, they decided to make it an offshore company in the Cayman Islands, or I forget where it was. And the lab, the lab would be in Geneva, because they couldn't build a lab in the U.S. then. It was still in all the recombinant DNA uproar. So it was to be in Switzerland, but Charles, being what Charles is like, well, they couldn't agree to the lab being in Zurich. So we put it in Geneva, so Charles couldn't be there all the time, which was a stupid idea. So it was very hard to run that lab. And after some period of time, maybe it was 2 years or less, they decided they really had to hire somebody to run Biogen, head of research. And I was sort of in the circle of people they were looking at.
Who else? Julian Davies?
Yes, Julian Davies. They offered the job to Richard, and he turned it down and went off to the Canaries on vacation. And then Phil said he would take it.
Phil Scharr.
Yeah, so Phil Scharr was going to leave MIT to take that job. And then Richard changed his mind and took the job. And then I forgot the thing with Davies. I don't know, maybe they split it at some point.
They opened a place in Cambridge here.
Yeah.
So maybe Richard came here, and then...
Yeah, that's right, Yeah, you're right. So, and Richard and I, by this time, Richard had left Weizmann's lab, moved to Holland, and if you look through the genealogy of Dutch molecular biology, he basically started... Well, he implemented the starting of molecular biology in Holland. There's a guy named Pete Boris. Pete Boris, too, was Charles's postdoc in New York, who went back to Amsterdam. And so Flavello was Pete Boris' graduate student, who was sent to Charles to learn real molecular biology, then went back to Pete's lab. And Richard ran the lab and trained a whole generation of molecular biologists who are now in their 60s. So then he moved to London. So the last few years I was in London, Richard had a big lab in Mill Hill, and I was in downtown London. And we had a lot of collaborations, people going back and forth, and worked together a lot, sort of socially all the time. So when he got the job at Biogen, he asked me to come with him. So that was actually how I got practically
involved. To go to Geneva?
No, to go... No, this, oh, was, this, to was, this was in... So this is already, must have been some years after the...
This is 82. Okay. And, well, what did you think about that offer?
So I thought it was kind of interesting. I didn't say no immediately. So I went to look at Biogen and spent a day there talking to people. And I wasn't impressed.
It was disorganized. They didn't know what they were. My understanding is.
Has to be very careful.
Yeah.
There were a lot of Wally postdocs there. They were all the people I talked to were very bright. But they mostly made me uncomfortable. It was almost like a personality or an emotional thing. There was something, you know, you could see these people weren't going to make it independently in academia. It was like he sort of parked people.
You know, I see.
That was just my impression. I couldn't know. And it may have been based on, I won't mention names now. So I did, and also the idea of going to work for your best friend, you know, it didn't seem... Didn't seem like the wisest thing to do.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure it would have worked out. Richard's a wonderful guy. Would have been fine to work there.
And were they talking about specific projects that they had in mind?
No, I didn't get that far. I know this is some time ago. I don't recall all the details, but what had happened. At about that time, I'd done some of the nicest work I'd ever done in my career in collaboration with a guy in Nice named Francois Cousin. And together we discovered the idea of oncogene cooperation, of a transforming gene and immortalizing gene. We published a paper. This is all in the DNA virus system. And I went to give a talk at a meeting in Houston on the first presentation of this concept of oxygen cooperation. And Bob Weinberg and David Baltimore were sort of sitting in the front row, and this became Weinberg's big thing afterwards. And Tom Aniadis was there. So Tom invited me to lunch.
Had you met him before?
Well, he was at Harvard when I was there.
Harvard, yeah.
Yeah, and I knew Tom.
I forget where he was going back and
forth. He was at Caltech, and then he went... I can't remember.
I think he made like a brief stop in Cambridge, but I think that was after you're gone. That doesn't matter. We can figure it out.
I knew him from my time in Cambridge.
Yeah, right, okay.
And I had sent him my best graduate student as a postdoc, a guy named Richard Treisman, who's been the head of ICRF for years now. Brilliant guy. So I guess Richard must have told Tom that I was looking at Biogen. I don't know, you know, the word gets around. So he knew that, and Tom and Flavel were good friends. So somehow he knew I'd been poking my nose around Biogen.
And did you know that he was working with potassium?
So at lunch he told me that he and Mark had founded this company, and it was silly for me to go to Biogen. Why didn't I come and be head of research at...
Well, why would it be silly to go to Biogen but not to go to GI?
I don't remember the conversation, but the pitch was, don't go there, come to us. That's how I got involved, and then I went to met Gabe, and was hired shortly after that.
Yeah, well, what kind of offer was it? What kind of work did they want you to do? Did they have plans? What was the salary? Did it all seem like a...
Well, you know, it seemed like a lot of money. You know,
it was better than the standard academic.
Well, we didn't get paid much of anything in London.
Did that play any part in your decision? The fact
You know, having some money. I'd never had any money since I was a graduate student.
Right. And the idea was you could still do some good science there.
Well, the deal was, so I was, what was I called, director of research, something like that. I was the first technical management. They had 12, 13 recent postdocs, and Tom and Mark were trying to run it, and Gabe had been brought in and was trying to run the business, but didn't really understand what was going on.
And Tom and Mark, they're still in their academic positions full time.
And they didn't. At least from the time I got there, they didn't spend very much time with the company. They were available, but they weren't really.
Yeah, the one day a week or whatever it was, they weren't there.
Meetings and things. They were helpful, but they weren't. They weren't really. Also, the company wasn't. The disconnect, you know, they do some methods, but they knew nothing about the subject matter the company was working on. Not that anyone else did, but it wasn't like today where a company would launch working on what a founder was working on. They weren't working on the, they weren't expert in what the company was doing.
Right.
Except from a technological point of view, some of the methods they had developed.
But did the fact that this is, you're walking out of academia into industry, did that mean anything? Or did you think, oh, what if I want to go back? Can I go back? You're very well connected,
it's a good question. Well, part of the deal then, you were allowed to have a hobby lab. Gabe didn't call it that. But to recruit somebody, in sort of early, mid-career, you had to allow them to bring some people and have a basic research lab. So I brought three or four people over, who mostly got absorbed into the company, one of which I married, which was the best thing in my life. my wife was a postdoc who joined my lab in London just a few months before I started talking about the GI thing. And she decided to come and finish her postdoc at GI.
Good.
She left Wyeth 20 years later.
made a career there.
Now she works for AbbVie. So she's made a very good career.
Oh, so she followed you to...
No, she left. She joined... we'll come to that.
Okay. All right. Well, the the job basically at that point, it's managing a lab. So you didn't think this is a different kind of management?
Well, no, it was different because, you know, they had sort of this funny space in the back half of the old Boston Lying In Hospital with the entrance at the back by the dumpster. And there was some lab space, and there were 12 or 13 young PhD scientists, you know, beavering away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the vast majority were very good. Mm-hmm. But there was no organization. I mean, no one ever figured out how to organize a biotech company. And there were postdocs. They weren't used to reporting to, you know, the whole idea of having a boss. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand having a boss. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gabe was this guy who hired me. Nice guy. Yeah. I talked to him, but, you know.
Well, how was that working with Gabe? I mean, it's new for him, right? What do I do with these people? These aren't like anybody I've worked for.
That wasn't always the most comfortable relationship. No. Worked out pretty badly at the end. But you know, we're all trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. So it was a big organization for me. Mm-hmm. It was a challenge to figure out how to, you know, get those people to accept some sort of supervision. You know, some of them wouldn't meet with me one-on-one. I had to invite them out to dinner.
They just refused to do it.
Well, made it clear they weren't comfortable with it somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't recall any great animosity. It was more like...
But it's like, no, we're going to keep this
more like
academic.
No, not academic.
No.
They just weren't used to having management. You know, mm-hmm. Scientists weren't managed. You know, they're all from MIT and Harvard, and, you know, mm-hmm. The thought of a boss, that didn't.
Yeah.
And they're all a bunch of interesting personalities. You know, some of them eventually accepted some kind of organization. Others did their own thing.
Who was there? Jay Toole was there?
Jay was there. Jay I had to take out to dinner.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't like the idea of supervision.
But did he adapt to it?
We got along.
Marginally.
We got along, yeah. Mm-hmm. And working for Jay was John Knopf.
Uh-huh.
It was quite a handful.
Yeah.
And John Wozni. I don't know if you know John Wozni.
I never met him.
Yeah, he's retired now, so mm-hmm. he became the great BMP guy. Mm-hmm. Ed Fritsch, Glenn Larson, Randy Kaufman, Chuck Shoemaker,
Steve Clark,
sure. Yeah, sorry. Steve was the first one I met. Hmm. Yeah, Steve.
Did that make a difference to you? You had to meet the people before you would decide?
I guess I probably spent, before I took the job, I spent some time talking to the people. And my impression was this was like night and day from Biogen.
Just in terms of the quality?
The quality, the commitment, you know, that I thought that Mark and Tom had hired very well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it was an exciting place. It was great people doing interesting things, but I knew nothing about the topics. You know, the project.
Well, where did the topics come from?
I'm not sure. I know.
Which were the first?
The Factor VIII project was probably Gabe. Yeah. And he came from Holland,
right.
And it was a hot topic. Mm-hmm. In the biotech industry at the time, mm-hmm. Maybe a bit obvious. They're working on tissue plasminogen activator, and that was
Something with interferon, like everybody else.
Well, no. So the initial idea was to work on interferon gamma, uh-huh. And they brought in, I guess, Potashny brought in David Goldie as a senior consultant, who was this lymphokine guy, expert from UCLA. Mm-hmm. And he was important because he had these human leukemic cell lines, and he had a cell line that was thought to make gamma interferon. This was very important at that time. Mm-hmm. And Steve's first contribution to GI was to spend a few weeks in Goldie's lab and prove that these cells didn't make gamma interferon.
What were they making?
Well, Goldie, bless him, said, well, they make GM-CSF, let's work on that.
So did you start then?
I know nothing. I'd never heard the term lymphokine when I took the job. Uh-huh. Didn't know anything about that. EPO was in the mix. Mm-hmm. And then there was some other stuff that didn't get continued. And there was there was an agricultural group that was starting up. There was an applied entomology group.
So they were going to make industrial enzymes?
Yeah, they did make industrial enzymes. He's a really good guy, brilliant guy.
What's
David Rozelle. He's a major person in that kind of work. Mm-hmm. But the value is very small. You know, what we learned is, you know, if you invent a much better way of making a commodity...
It's still a commodity.
It's still a commodity, and if you save them 15 cents per ton, they'll give you two, you know,
right.
or something like that. So there really wasn't any business there.
Yeah.
Although the intellectual quality of the work. Rozelle was a guy who engineered cell-free enzyme pathways. You take this enzyme, turn it around, couple it with that enzyme, turn backwards, and end up with a bioreactor that made a kilo of valine in a day or something like that. It was always very impressive. But, you know, we didn't keep that.
Yeah, so at some point, just cut it loose.
Yeah, but it was a steep learning curve. You know, we had to figure out what it was to have a biotech company and what the right subjects were and how to manage the projects. You know, it's the whole idea of project management, didn't know anything about that. So we had the benefit of having partnerships, and Factor VIII was partnered with Baxter, which, you know, had its pluses and minuses. And they also had some growing to do, but after a while they got organized, and they had this very charming guy, forgotten his name now, who was a project manager, and he seemed to be incredibly helpful and really things worked better when he joined. So I took him out to lunch and asked him what he did. And he explained that he was a project manager and he did this. And I said, let's came back to told Gabe, this is a great idea. We should have a project management group. But that's how we were just picking up.
And what were the principles of project management that you tried to apply?
Well, just the idea that you wouldn't divide the organization of the project, the timelines and the budget and the meeting schedule and the reports from doing the science. Not, you know, just because you have a brilliant scientist to encumber him with, you know, these project teams were getting big. There are lots of moving parts. That's what's exciting. You know, if we had 15, 20, 30 people on I guess we never got that big, say 15 people on a project, all doing different stuff. You got to keep that organized. You got to check on all these people. So we, I guess, innovative, at least at that time, I hired a project manager, and he kind of figured out what to do, and he worked, you know, in parallel with the senior scientific leadership doing the administrative organizational part of the project to get the projects moved forward. The first guy I hired was David Stone. I don't know if you know him. He became an investment analyst, quite successful for Cowan and Company for a long time. Now he's a venture capitalist.
So how did these projects proceed? Factor VIII, that was...
Factor VIII
was a successful one. Yeah.
Factor VIII was successful. It was tough. It was successful, you know, to a certain extent. It was hard to make a lot of Factor VIII. But it was one of the few battles with Genentech that we managed to clearly win. And we felt a lot of hemophiliacs. I think the GI recombinant Factor VIII was the first approved, and still, you know, there's a lot of. I still occasionally meet a hemophiliac who's been taking it, and that was a good experience. EPO, as you know, was a little bit too late, 2 weeks.
Well, you think it was the timing? Is that how?
For the bat, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a strategic error.
The filing?
No. The person who deserves all the credit for the recombinant EPO is a very bizarre Japanese urologist, I think, named...
I know who you're talking about.
Blanking on his name now. Miyake. Miyake. Because he purified EPO at the University of Chicago for Goldwasser, Eugene Goldwasser, but Goldwasser had nothing to do with it. This guy was a senior clinical guy who'd co- collected urine from aplastic anemic patients and dried it down and brought it to Goldwasser's lab to purify EPO. Didn't know any biochemistry, had not the foggiest idea how to purify something, but he managed it. And he gave a sample of his EPO to Goldwasser, who gave it to Lee Hood, who had it sequenced in his lab, and then put the information into Amgen.
Right.
In the sequence. So GI hired, Rod Hewick, the one person I left out.
Right.
Hewick, wonderful man.
And you purchased, did you purchase the sequencer, Hood sequencer, the ABI?
So Rod was involved and was the postdoc in Hood's lab, who with Hunkepiller invented the gas phase sequinator. And Hunkepiller went into ABI, and Rod came to GI. Really good move of Gabe, that Gabe had. And it was very competitive. Amgen wanted him. And he brought with him a little bit of EPO sequence. So the two companies started out with the same amount of information, but Amgen had more EPO and got more sequence.
You had a couple of errors in the sequence. Did Amgen have the same errors?
No, I think it was an intron. It wasn't enough information anyway. So Ed Fritsch was working diligently trying to do genomic cloning with synthetic oligos based on Rod Hewick's sequence. And he wasn't really getting anywhere. And we'd had some contact with Miyake. Miyake had since left Chicago, probably going back to Japan, and then took a job in some place in Columbus, Ohio, kind of a strange institute, charity-funded institute. And he came to visit us and give a seminar, which I found most underwhelming. I learned later the guy was really sober, which the guy was bizarre. And the quality of the work, you know, it would have been luck to get something out of it. And that was early on when I was a GI, I sort of poo-pooed it. And then sometime later, I'm seeing that Fritsch is kind of bogged down, and I'm saying, well, we really need some more EPO. And realize I made a mistake, that we should really suck up to Miyake and see if we could buy some more EPO. And there have been some discussions, I think. So I've been out to visit him in the meantime at this strange place he was at, and that hadn't led to anything. He was hard to communicate with. He didn't speak much English, and I don't recall the details anymore, but it was just kind of a bizarre interaction. Then I still remember very clearly I had a meeting in my office, which was a patient recovery room in this old hospital with Ed Fritsch, and suddenly realized that he was stuck. It just came to me that this just wasn't going to work. And in the meanwhile, the business part of GI had hired this guy, Manchu Yang, who was Taiwanese, I think. He was Asian, anyway. And he had sort of an Asian way of dealing with things. And I picked up my phone, I called Manchu and said, could you come in here? And he came in and I said, we need some more EPO. Would you please get on a plane and go talk to Miyake and figure out how to get some EPO? I just had this idea that Manchu could probably deal with it. You know, Taiwanese, Japanese.
Yeah.
Well, but Manchu had a way with him that he would, I thought that he could communicate. Just a guess. So we went there, and some days later, he called from the airport and said, Miyake wants $300,000. Can I pay him? I forgot, it was $200,000, $300,000. He gave agreed. And we sent the money, or agreed to pay the money, and Manchu came back with a little vial of EPO, and Rod sequenced it, got more sequence, and Ed cloned it in less than a month from that phone call. So, as I said, it was, you know, we should have, first time we had this bizarre man in, we should have realized that he was special. And
okay, so when you cloned it then 2 weeks earlier, Amgen.
Yeah, Amgen had cloned it earlier,
But there was a patent dispute. It was the sequence? Did you patent this?
Yeah, so Hewick filed a patent on pure EPO because the Miyake EPO was the gold standard. And the sample we got from Miyake was Miyake's pure EPO, rod to put it on an HPLC and discovered it was half pure.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the peak that was pure EPO and filed a patent on mm-hmm. pure EPO in parallel. Just before that, Amgen filed a patent on the CDNA sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, but realistically, both companies had applied state-of-the-art technology. They hadn't invented anything. The real invention was this heroic effort to
mm-hmm.
spend 5 or 10 years collecting urine from aplastic anemic patients and then figure out how to purify it, not knowing anything about purification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's, we know how that turned out ultimately, that which was bad for GI later on. But
yeah, that was.
Mm-hmm. But there were some successes. Well, I guess gamma interferon didn't really go anywhere.
But GM-CSF did, and we ended up having a very strong hematopoietic growth factor group that Steve Clark led, and they cloned lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So GM-CSF moved into the clinic. That was a collaboration with Sando, which was difficult. They were very early in the recombinant protein learning curve, and it was challenging working with them.
What were the problems? I mean, you guys were the experts, right?
They didn't have people to carry the work forward. They weren't really committed.
Mm.
They were very disorganized. It was not impressive.
So was it?
So I had to not infrequently get the head of R&D on the phone and try to complain about the performance of the people and try to get them to do something. And it was managing sort of like this.
Sure. Was it at some point? Did you get the feeling, oh, we need to back out of this somehow? Is there any way?
Oh, we had lots of meetings at GI about getting out of the deals.
Yeah.
No, we offered Baxter a substantial lump sum to get factor VIII back.
Because you thought to derive the value from it.
Well, you know, it was a great opportunity for GI early on to get equity from Baxter, but they weren't exactly quick in development. And also, at least I guess we came to realize that they weren't the ideal partner because they had to maximize the value of their factor VIII business. You know, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't underprice their blood-derived factor VIII. You know, they had a business, they had a franchise to maintain.
Sure.
So they have to figure out a strategy to roll the next gen in, increasing value, but not, you know, mm-hmm. they didn't want to dip into things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, had we done it ourselves or given it to somebody who wasn't in the business, they could have, you know, done.
Right.
They could have competed with Baxter. Got it out faster and at a lower price.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we thought, you know, we could do better, but of course that was not something that Baxter was going to agree to.
Yeah.
It didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So it was a bit frustrating. You know, the farm industry was much, much less able than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we had a lot of partnerships, and I was the main liaison between the management of two companies, and all of those relationships were challenging.
Mm-hmm. And the bone growth factors, who were the partners with?
That was unpartnered.
Okay. So nobody else is really doing that? That was one project that...
No, the scientists at GI had to whip me into agreeing to do that. That was...
You didn't think it was a good idea because maybe
I agreed,
doing?
But there's a guy named Bob Kay who left GI... He is the guy who set up what became Medirex, which is now the vital part of BMS.
Mm-hmm.
He left GI, moved to the West Coast, and built. He hired the guy who's now the head of BMS's oncology division.
Mm-hmm.
But this is transgenic animals that make antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on that too.
Oh.
Yeah. So Bob had.
So he was working at it there at GI.
No, somebody else was.
I see. But did that person go?
No. Uh-huh. That's a separate story.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So Bob had gotten excited about BMP, but the literature was really bad. It was really murky, mystical stuff,
mm-hmm.
and wasn't very convincing. So we had a whole series of meetings, and eventually Bob and a couple other people convinced me that we should do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't my first predilection. He gets a lot of credit for it. He's very persistent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then this woman, Elizabeth Wong, actually purified BMT.
Mm-hmm. It was a difficult thing to do?
Very hard.
Why? There wasn't, cells didn't produce very much of it?
Cells. Cow legs.
Yeah, yeah.
So Liz is quite something. She's a biochemist, but a really tough lady. And so she agreed to do this. She was excited about the challenge. She read the papers. And the next day she comes into my office, or next week, with a requisition for a bone saw, a bone grater. And they went to the slaughterhouse and got these legs and cut the hooves off. So there was a published procedure from Leon Urist, I think is his name, who discovered, who invented BMP.
So nobody knew where these, where
well,
it was
no,
being produced?
You extracted it with urea by grinding up bone, cow bone, cooking it up in urea to take the soluble portion out, and then fractionating the extracted protein. It stank, and it was awful. So Liz managed to purify what she thought was BMP, and that led to the project. But she wasn't the easiest of people to deal with. Had not the best interpersonal skill. Brilliant, but a bit of a special person. And she had a scientist that she hired named Sampath, Kubira Sampath, I think. I don't know if you want to know all this sort of detail.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was, I think, either from Urist Lab or from somewhere else at the NIH, and he actually had experience in BMP. So he was quite knowledgeable, but no one ever purified one homogeneity. And Sampath and Wang ended up having a conflict, and she thought that he was fudging his data because what he thought was BMP was not what she thought was BMP. Something like which peak on a column was active. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, the other problem, to purify it, the only assay was a one-month rat implant model. So you took your extract, dried it down, put it in a collagen capsule, a gelatin capsule, implanted in the flank of a rat, and waited for a bone chip. Can you imagine purifying something?
Yeah. So when you're trying to decide should we do this or not do this, did you know that this is what it would entail?
Yeah. I thought this was. I'd say they had to wear me down. This didn't seem like science. You know, the whole thing was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
So these two scientists, Liz was the boss, and she wanted to fire Sampath. And I ended up backing her because she seemed to have a rational reason. So he went to another company, which became the other source of BMP. Of course, there were 14 BMPs. They were both right. But we didn't know. Mm-hmm. At that point in science, we didn't know.
Yeah. You ever get a chance to apologize to him?
I don't think it was all that acrimonious. Yeah. He did okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, at that time, the thought was we would purify BMP. There would be one peak coming off a column.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It hadn't occurred to us that they both could be right.
Yeah.
Because the personalities were in conflict anyway. Mm-hmm.
And that turned into a product.
Yeah.
Or maybe several family products.
No, it's one product which is in trouble now. I think it may. It hit about $1 billion.
Yeah.
It's
a blockbuster. Yeah.
Well, for Medtronic, it was the most successful product ever in spine. But it has some side effect now. The sales have dropped tremendously. And that was developed with Medtronic because it had to be a device. It's an implantable device.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was after I left.
Other notable projects or things happening during this period?
Well, we didn't talk about TPA. TPA was a big project, and that was a collaboration with Joe Sambrook at Cold Spring Harbor. Probably his idea. I don't remember. That was before I joined GI.
Mm-hmm.
We put a lot of work into that. That was partnered with Wellcome. And that was quite a good partnership. Welcome was good to work with.
Why were they better than the others?
Good people.
And their interests aligned.
They had a company called... They were just staffing up. I don't think they were scientifically up to what GI had. But they had a unit called Welcome Biotech. I forgot this guy's name who ran it. He and Gabe became very good friends. Blanking on his name, very dynamic business guy. And so that relationship went fine. Mm-hmm. And we developed a first-generation TPA, which is the same as Genentech's. That was just one of these competitions, but we were a little bit later than them. Mm-hmm. And then we developed a next-generation TPA with improved PK. And those, unfortunately, both got involved in a patent suit with Genentech. Mm-hmm. And the second generation had been developed particularly with regard to the patent position, because the Genentech patent claims were extremely narrow. They were just TPA, because they really hadn't done anything. Desiree Collin had given them a portion of the TPA he had purified and already treated patients with. So, and they had tons of it. They sequenced some and cloned it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you couldn't get a patent these days for something like that, but they did. Mm-hmm. But because of the narrow scope of their inventiveness, they got a patent only on TPA itself, not fragments thereof or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we had a sort of a deletion mutant, a variant of TPA which had improved properties. And unfortunately, the patent case on the first generation TPA, Genentech in its legal wisdom included in the suit arguments including the second gen, because it was the same partner, Welcome had both. Mm-hmm. And the case went to a jury trial, and the jury decided in favor of Genentech on the whole case, not understanding any of it. And the judge, in his final remarks, pointed out to the jury that Genentech didn't have a patent on the second gen, but it was too late.
So there's no appeal?
It was appealed and reversed 6 years later.
But by then it's...
No, I think it got... After I left, I think it was relicensed. Welcome gave it back. It was licensed to BMS, I think. Hmm. And they did a big clinical trial, which I don't think was positive, but that was after I left. Hmm. But it was still late.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well... How did you feel about you have to deal with these commercial and legal dimensions of the work, which you know you hadn't done before?
That was all very exciting, you know.
Was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the GI, so Gabe had this sort of management team that ran the company, which is him and either two or three or four people, depending on the times. So I was in that group and involved in, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very stimulating. Did you ever feel
it was,
like...
It was stimulating, but very stressful. But by the end, by 89, I was pretty much worn out. Because GI had a pretty rocky period. We were involved. We lost the TPA case.
And then EPO
I just didn't agree with Gabe about the EPO strategy. I didn't think we...
The legal strategy?
Legal strategy. I didn't think it was worth fighting.
Yeah.
You know, I proved to be right, but...
Yeah.
Who knows?
Right, so that was the source
It was very difficult times for Gabe, for everybody, because the company was on the line, we had quite a few people, he was worried about the continuity of the company. And, you know, 1 week we'd have this executive committee meeting and he'd be selling the company, and the next week he'd come in and say everything is fine and the data hadn't changed. So I was driving him crazy because I kept picking at the financial data and, mm-hmm. you know, I think he was just...
Yeah,
trying to do his best. We ended up in great conflict. Mm-hmm.
And at some point you decided...
No, he kicked me out.
He did.
Yeah. It was pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. You know, we're back reconnected again.
Good.
But, you know, I was just burned out. It had been very, very difficult. I was working 70 hours a week. And, you know, it was pretty tough. And the other thing that was challenging, in the end of the 80s, it was hard to know what to do with the therapeutics recombinant DNA company. because most of the newer projects we started failed. You know, the whole idea that you could have a cell line, fish around and supernatant and find something that cured cancer, you know, fundamentally made no sense.
It's a lot more complicated.
Because once you learned about the pharmaceutical industry, you know, you have to start with the disease, figure out the disease mechanism, and then make a drug that interfere with the disease mechanism. You know, it doesn't mean that you could, just because you had a cell line that made some activity. So it was a little depressing, I think, probably throughout the whole industry at that time. You know, the low-hanging fruit had been picked, mm-hmm. and where the industry was going was a bit unclear. Maybe that was just in my mind.
So, but that did start to dawn on you late 80s?
Yeah, late 80s.
Yeah.
I also was tired of being on the biotech side of the table, since I had, maybe we had 6-7 collaborations, and you know, maybe one or two of them went well, but you know, dealing with big pharma from the inferior position. So my goal was to switch to the other side of the table.
Did you have, what was your, well, first of all, let me ask you, this is getting frustrating, all kinds of problems. Were you at any point longing for the good old days in academia?
No, never. I love work in industry.
Yeah.
That was for me, you know, having resources and a big team and getting stuff done, mm-hmm. and having a stable group of really high quality, you know, we could really do stuff at GI.
Yeah.
You know, really good professionals. You know, you didn't have to worry in general about the scientific quality. Things just got done. I love that.
Mm-hmm. And this
bigger would have been better from my point of view.
Yeah. So, and you discovered this by getting into GI.
Sure.
And then seeing how it developed. And yeah.
Yeah. And I liked doing the whole integrated thing of having a company, and mm-hmm. you know, it was, academia is intellectually exciting, but also a big ego trip. And I didn't like that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in a company, you know, you're really doing something. And
with
good stuff,
team.
You know, you're helping patients, you know, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was how to do that, but do it in a more maybe secure environment, free of Wall Street. And at that time, you know, Wall Street didn't understand biotech the way they do today. Mm-hmm. And I had to talk with analysts all the time. And it was frustrating that you were almost forced to inflate, because they discounted anything you said tenfold. So if you just told them the truth, mm-hmm. it would be like the company's falling apart.
Right. You might.
I think things have gotten a lot better. You know, the mm-hmm. industry is much more sophisticated.
Yeah.
But those interactions weren't very pleasant.
Yeah.
So at the time when things were getting difficult with Gabe, I was being recruited by a major pharma company. And I was so loyal to GI, I couldn't even mm-hmm. talk to the people.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed wrong. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if I just left, it wouldn't be so bad. I'd just move on to a big pharma company.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your notion of what big pharma, you were dealing with those folks,
yeah.
but did you have the very different kinds of organizations? Even when GI gets to be over 1,000 people, it's still tiny compared to a big pharma corporation. Do you think you had a good idea of what working in an organization like that would be like?
No, since I ended up doing it, the honest answer is no, but I don't remember what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
No, my thought process was mostly that I didn't want to be on the inferior end of a partnership again.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, having to, I was comfortable managing people, but having to manage people indirectly by going to their boss to, you know, that was just not something I wanted to continue to do. That's what I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And pharma was improving by the end of the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the age of blockbuster drugs, so they were very rich, right?
Yeah,
they didn't have
any. Anyway, I hadn't thought about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what's your move? Gabe decides it's time for you to go, and so, well, there you are. What's there? I am.
You know, I have a job.
Yeah, so how did you respond to that? What was your reaction?
Not well, I was pretty low.
Yeah,
I have a good wife.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of gardening and planting plants and looking around. And, you know, I had options, but I also didn't want to leave the Boston area. So I want to have a senior job in a pharma company in the Boston area. mm-hmm. which is a little difficult in 1990.
Was your wife still she was still GI?
She was still GI, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, there's a lot going on here, though. You didn't want to go to...
There wasn't any big pharma.
Yeah, you didn't want to go to another biotech.
Well, no, I went. It was about a 6-month process with this company that was trying to recruit me, which ended up with a dinner with Roy Vatrilos, and he said no.
Was this Regeneron?
Merck.
Oh, it was when he was still at Merck. Yeah. I see. Yeah, okay.
Yes, so the job was to be Skolnick's successor at Merck, but Skolnick wanted me and Vatrilos didn't, so that was just, well... Turned out it was a lifesaver because there have been at least 10 people hired in that position who got hired and chewed up and spit out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it would have been a disaster.
Mm-hmm. So that was an extended process.
Well, yeah, and then
what? And had they contacted you when you were still at GI?
Yeah. Ed had. We'd had dealings with Merck about TPA. And Ed really wanted to license TPA, and he and I knew each other from academic life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so we reacquainted ourselves in our new commercial roles. And he had insisted that it was impossible to make a recombinant protein in CHO cells, and that they would only enter into a partnership with us at TPA if we switched the cell line to yeast.
Why did they think that?
I don't know. So he and I had this conversation in the Merck cafeteria, and I remember I said, Ed, you're wrong. We're not going to switch. Mm-hmm. That was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he realized some years later that I was right and tried to hire me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have in my notes here that the Whitehead Institute, visiting scientist.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So David Baltimore invited me to hang out at the Whitehead.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I spent some time there. That I felt really like a fish out of water going back from GI to the Whitehead. It was really strange.
Yeah, were you thinking about maybe starting up some kind of line of research? Or?
Well, you know, I toyed with it. I did interview for some academic jobs, but it just wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
And then fortunately, Jim stepped in again. As I said, Jim knows what's happening. You know, I hadn't talked to him very much all through this whole process, since we weren't close. But one day, out of the blue, I get a call from Mike Wigler at Cold Spring Harbor, who's this superstar genius at Cold Spring Harbor. And Mike and I knew each other from our graduate student days. And Mike says, Bob, Jim told me you're out of work. I got an idea for a company.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike,
so a startup company.
Startup company, yeah. So Mike wanted to start up a recombinant antibody company.
And produce them in CHO cells, or what?
Well, he'd invented what ended up becoming phage display.
I see. He was involved in the first patent, right?
Remember yeah.
Said? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was there was a company that was going. Mike wanted to start a company, and I agreed that I would work with him. Started thinking about antibodies, which I hadn't thought about very much. Mm-hmm. GI had a little antibody group, but it wasn't mm-hmm. never. Person doing it wasn't very good. So he had this recombinant way of making antibodies by screening libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted somebody to help him make that into a company and figure out what to do with it. So I started thinking about antibodies, and it was like, Eureka, these are drugs. You know, you could think about a disease process, you could make an antagonist.
And these are human antibodies that you're talking about, yeah.
But I hadn't thought about using antibodies chronically because they were mouse and you couldn't do them chronically. But you know, the problem at that time was making drugs that blocked protein to cell surface protein receptor interactions, like making an IL-1 antagonist. It's a hot project for many companies. Trying to do a small molecule is impossible.
Why is it impossible?
Just basic physics. The surfaces of interaction between proteins are very large,
mm-hmm.
and the affinity is very, very high. And you know, to have a little, you know, a small molecule is just too small.
Yeah.
So okay. Small molecule drugs block receptors that are small molecule receptors.
Yeah. Okay.
But you know, blocking a protein, no one's ever done that. It's impossible.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And suddenly, I realized, well, you know, if you could really make an antibody, this would be hot. you know, this could be a whole big thing. So we worked, it was funny. So Mike brought in a friend of his from Columbia named George Yancopoulos, who would have helped start this company. And
okay, so this is Regeneron.
No, well,
it could have been.
Yeah. I only had a couple of meetings with George. He was impressive. And Gustav Christensen was involved on the business side. I don't know if you know him. He was Gabe's lieutenant, another Baxter guy. He's now the CEO of Diax. So Gustav, was he between? He was also between jobs, I think. Must have been. Or he's doing it on the side, I don't recall. So we started this company called Humatech, and we had a Japanese guy involved who was very well plugged in with a wealthy young Japanese businessman. So this was 89, it was the high point of the Japanese economy. And there was this guy who was the heir to a noodle company that was getting involved in pharmaceuticals. And we had this plan that he would finance it, and he agreed. He wanted to put in a lot of money. It would have been a wonderful deal. But his father stopped him. So that whole thing fell apart. But I'd been excited, but I decided I wasn't going to go to VCs. I just didn't want to do it.
What did you know about VCs?
Probably naive. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Can't recall.
Yeah. So you just dropped that project.
Yeah, so I dropped that and started looking for a job again. And then fortunately another one of these strange phone calls. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening. I was cooking dinner for my wife. I was home cooking. And Bob Weinberg calls me up and says, "Hi, Bob." I hadn't spoken to Bob Weinberg in like 3 years, something like that. He says, "Hi, Bob. You live in Sudbury, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." And then he says, "Is that anywhere near Worcester?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't know where Worcester is." So I said, I suppose so.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember the rest of the conversation, but he said he was on the scientific advisory board for this company, BSF BioResearch, and they were looking for a president, and they were going to build this company in Worcester. Would I be willing to talk to them?
So a biotech arm of...
Yes, and so at that time I was well along with taking a job working for Burlex, which is the U.S. arm of Schering, because they had bought two companies on the West Coast, Triton and Codon, and they wanted somebody to put the two companies together and run that, and I've been spending a lot of time on the West Coast. And
so you're just looking at a lot of different things. Yeah.
Well, actually, two German companies turned out, because that was run out of Berlin. But we didn't want to move to the West Coast. The kids were in school, and it would have been difficult. So then it happened, it only took about a week or two, so I knew about this BSF BioResearch because there was a GI attorney who'd gone there. They were in Cambridge. Just started up.
Small, very small.
About 15 people, something like that. So I
agreed. Was their plan to do pharmaceuticals or industrial things?
Oh, pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Oh, this is part of history. You have to learn about BSF BioResearch.
Okay.
And this is...
Good.
So, this scientist from Germany flies over. I meet him. He's a very nice guy. He drives me out to Worcester. They've bought 25 acres of hilltop property just above the medical school. This beautiful piece of property. And they're building a 376,000 square foot building. Just the foundation was in. And this guy Werner says to me, "Would you like to do something with this? Figure out what to do with it. We want to build a big biotech company here." So I went to Germany and met some other people, all very nice. And I was more happy. I spent 13 years in Europe, and I like working with Europeans.
Why?
Cultural, I don't know. My wife is Dutch. We spent a lot of time in Holland, and you know, my daughter now is retro emigrated. She lives in Germany. She's a Dutch citizen. So we're the family.
How would you describe the contrast, though? The cultural contrast. What are the differences?
I have to think about that. I don't know.
My brother lives in Germany, and he says Germans are a lot like Americans. Well, I don't know.
That's a long topic.
Yeah. Okay. But so this seemed like something really good. It's
well, no, this was perfect. So yeah. So it was a big company. I had no appreciation how big. Of course, I had to ask, well, who's BASF? I never heard of BASF. I knew about the tapes. Mm-hmm. And you probably don't know about BASF either.
Well, it's a big chemical company.
Yeah, it's the world's biggest chemical company.
Yeah.
It's huge. No, it's at that time they on the Ludwigshafen headquarters site they had 110,000 employees. Mm-hmm. The site is 27 square kilometers.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a big company,
right?
And very complicated, very well run. Mm-hmm. And they have BASF North America is a Fortune 100 company. They have 47 big factories in the U.S. alone. And you know,
every
part of the world. I didn't know that when this job came along.
Yeah,
and they had a small pharma division, which was largely a German company called Knoll, K-N-O-L-L-E, that was the only other business in this mm-hmm. small city of Ludwigshafen, Germany.
Yeah.
So I took that job. It just seemed wonderful because they wanted I to be president. You know, I didn't have anyone over me, at least in this part of the world.
Great facility.
And, you know, the budget, I guess my peak annual budget was about $125 million, something like that.
Which is way beyond anything that you, at GI, what were your budgets?
I don't recall.
Tenth of that or something?
Yeah, probably a tenth of that. But, you know, so, and they didn't really have a firm idea of what to do,
and it turned. Did you have one?
Well, I'll give you a little history. Okay. So BASF BioResearch came about. It started off as a collaboration between a small biotech group in Germany. BASF decided about 1980 they should do something in biotech, and they have smaller now. But then they had this big central laboratory, about 1,500 scientists, something like that. Serving the whole company, so mostly chemistry research. But they, for I don't know the reason, but they decided they should do something in biotechnology, and they had a small biotech group, and the guy who came over was the head of that group. And they also had bought, some years before, this pharma company, and they brought the medicinal chemistry group from the pharma company into their main laboratory, and that was sort of side by side with the biotech group. Mm-hmm. But they realized that they had to collaborate, so they did some deals. They did a deal with Integrated Genetics for TPA and a deal with Biogen for TNF. And the two senior people from this main lab were coming over about every 3 months to Cambridge to meet with Integrated Genetics, and that's Tremier. Mm-hmm. Well, the company Tremier bought.
Right. It was after Tremier had bought them.
No, this is before.
Okay.
This is 85, they started working with Integrated Genetics.
Oh, okay.
And they're working with Biogen, and these two guys got this idea that they really shouldn't do biotech in Germany, they should build a company in the U.S. in Cambridge. And they were eyeing a site. There was a vacant site right next to Biogen. So they actually wrote a proposal to BASF that they should buy that land and build a company. Mm. But they never took it to the BASF executive board. They, in a big company, you know, you don't take something forward, you don't know it's going to get approved, and they were getting strong messages that they were not going to do research out of Germany. Mm-hmm. This main laboratory was 100 years old, they had two mm-hmm. Nobel Prizes, they thought they were the best in the world in the idea of doing this. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., at least for the senior people in BASF, was too foreign.
So did they go ahead in Germany?
No, so they went ahead in Germany, they had TNF in the clinic, they took over clinical development. They were using TNF as a cancer drug, trying to use TNF as a cancer drug. But BASF, being a chemical company, is very manufacturing-oriented. And what it does is build huge manufacturing plants that organize them. That's the strength of the company. So they viewed biotechnology as another manufacturing thing. So they designed and broke ground for a TNF production plant, you know, bacterial recombinant DNA plant, on a site in their big headquarters site. And in 89, the German government, in its wisdom, passed the famous gene law where they outlawed biotech production in Germany. So the same two guys who'd have this idea for doing it in the U.S. said, aha, maybe they'll listen now.
Yeah.
So they dusted off this old document. Within a few weeks, took it to the BSF executive board, got approval, and they also knew that if you want approval in BSF, you ask for capital. Because chemical companies spend a lot of capital. They're very organized for capital decisions. There actually are commissions within BSF which vet capital requests. There's all sorts of paperwork and mm-hmm. numbers. So they asked for $100 million to build a building. Mm-hmm. Because they knew that would be a decision that could be made.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when I got hired. I learned this after I went to Germany.
Fascinating. Yeah.
But they didn't really have
an idea of what to do.
It was on rebound. They had this idea that the biotechnology was really going to go somewhere.
Did they still have TNF in their clinic?
So I took this job, and what I had in mind was, I'll do antibodies.
Phage display?
Well, yeah, by that time, Greg Winter had invented phage display. And I thought that, if you could make an antibody, and if you could use it chronically, you could open a whole new field. And what I decided to do, we had a portfolio of all sorts of different projects, but one of the things we decided to do was to try to build a fully human antibody platform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was like GI in the beginning. We hadn't moved into the big building. We were in Cambridge in rented labs. And there were about 19, 20 people. Nobody with any industrial experience, all postdocs. Same thing again.
But it is inside the big company, so that makes a big difference for you. Right?
Yeah.
When you're negotiating partnerships, you're
doing it. But so we were in a position where, so we decided we were going to do an antibody, and we picked TNF as a target because we actually had a mouse anti-TNF in the clinic for sepsis too. And the guy who had invented that antibody to set up BSF BioResearch, they approved the $100 million, and they approved sending over 6 young scientists as delegates, all of them under 30.
Mm-hmm.
3 from Knoll, 3 from BSF. They shipped them off to the States and said, build a company. Mm-hmm. One was president. It's an amazing thing that how BSF develops talent. They just,
go do it, see if you can sink or swim.
There was supervision from Germany, but it was pretty hands-off.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the 5, Eric Schlick, had been promoted back to Germany after a year and a half, so I succeeded him as president, but with some more authority than mm-hmm. he had. But one of the scientists who'd been shipped over actually was coming back to Cambridge. He'd been a postdoc at MIT, and he was a monoclonal guy, and he'd made a mouse anti-TNF.
Mm-hmm.
And we had kilos of high-quality recombinant TNF, and it seemed like TNF wasn't a bad target for a therapeutic antibody. We didn't have a well-defined clinical indication.
But okay, so this is the beginning of Humira?
Yeah.
Yeah, so starch, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, okay. So we needed a target, and, I knew enough about industry to say, they were romancing me with this great job, but I knew if I didn't have something in the clinic pretty damn fast, I wasn't going to keep that job, and they weren't going to keep this unit. Honeymoon doesn't last forever. So we wanted to do antibodies, so we had to collaborate with somebody. We didn't have any technology to make a human antibody. And the target had to be something that this small group of people knew about. They knew about TNF, they had assays. So, it seemed like a logical thing to do. And you could write down on the blackboard 10 possible indications. None of it really mm-hmm. proven.
Mm-hmm.
So we set out to make a human equivalent to the mouse antibody that was already in the clinic, because that couldn't be given repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, Greg Winter had founded CAT with a guy named Dave Chiswell. Chiswell now, mm-hmm. he's the great leader of British biotech.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave had been a postdoc at ICRF.
Oh, you knew him?
Yeah, and I taught David something, Western blots, I don't know, Northern, probably Northern blots, mm-hmm. something like that. So we used to go drink at the pub together.
Mm-hmm.
So shortly after I took this job with BASF, decided antibodies, thinking about TNF, and we were there were the beginnings of Abgenix and Metarex making transgenic mice, one of which was an XGI guy. We knew about these technologies, knew about phage display, but we didn't know which one. Mm-hmm. So I went out to a PEGS conference in San Diego, ran into Dave Chiswell, at lunch with him, he told me about this company, Cambridge Identified Technology, that he and Greg had started, that they had a couple of people, they were getting going, and they thought the technology worked, and they weren't really sure. So we said, okay, we'll do it together. I got some people, you got some people, we'll put a deal together. We'll try to make a fully human antibody against TNF. And it took the lawyers and all the other people time and how to get approvals and all that sort of stuff.
But it's easier for you not doing this inside BASF.
Sure, because I was the superior in this case. So, and Chiswell was amazing. He was the CSO. We was running the company, and they went through three or four CEOs and finally had the wisdom to give him the job. But he put a supporting proposition. He said, the deal is you pay us 600,000 pounds when we deliver an antibody or part of antibody fragment, and what was the detail, which you think is good enough to develop clinically. If we don't make it, don't pay us anything. Those were the terms. And then we got, I think, three more targets on the same terms.
So no problem getting that approved, right?
No.
Yeah.
And I tried to do some collaborations based on chemistry, but that BASF wouldn't accept because they didn't think anyone else could do medicinal chemistry as well as they could, which may or may not be correct, but they were pretty damn good. But in this field, you know, that's what they want. That's what they hired me to do. They wanted to use the network.
Yeah. Did it make sense to be located in Worcester?
Yeah, it worked out very well.
What were the advantages?
We moved into Worcester in 94. And this massive build. So the building was half production plant, half research lab. And this amazing production facility. It was largely in shell, but the infrastructure for water purification, waste disposal, you know, BASF really knows how to do that. There's all this amazing miles of beautiful stainless steel pipe, and much better than whatever GGI ever had. And there was a guy, Peter Moesta, who was one of the German delegates, who's super. He was in charge of the facility. He built the whole production thing. So that was a big asset. And they were willing to back this collaboration. So it made a great deal of sense. At the time, it took, you know, everything has its ups and downs. You know, they tried to shut us down a few times. And, it wasn't easy. You know, developing any drug is never...
Sure. It was just at some point, if somebody's saying it's taking too long.
I mean, if there are, you know, any...
You've got supporters and detractors inside the company, yeah?
Yeah, and politics. There are people.
Sure.
Yeah, well, you know, normal stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to fight for anything.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, being involved in a big... I'd never been involved in a big company, and this was really... This is a big company.
Yeah, so what did you learn about that?
Well, you know, I had to learn, you know, the culture of German companies, which is the opposite of what I expected. I expected it to be rigorously hierarchical, and it was rigorously democratic, with a few outliers, but everything was done by consensus. And I learned, not surprisingly in retrospect, that strong, dominant individuals are feared and not respected in Germany.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to be collegial and everybody has to agree, and, you know, if there's somebody with a certain responsibility, they may be hierarchical three layers below you. You know, you can't order them around. You got to convince him if he doesn't agree. So, you know, there's all consensus building. It was interesting.
So how do you feel about that approach?
I think it's a very sound approach.
I mean, it can get tied up, though. Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to be reasonable.
Everybody has to be reasonable.
But, you know, you don't want to... A one-man show, and you don't want to order people around. But it was a very interesting learning experience. And we did lots of it. So, like, the company was... It went from, you know, about 20 people to up to about 450 before I retired. And it was very good. We recruited a lot of people. Being in Worcester was, you know, academics will come and give talks if you send a limo. But your employees like to have a nice place to live they can afford. So I don't understand the whole Kendall Square thing, honestly.
Yeah.
Not for a startup, I understand it. But if you're building
Brewing company coming in. Yeah.
Yeah, because you know, Worcester is it's a lovely site, easy to get to. There's no traffic, and employees can live well. We live in Shrewsbury. There are lots of communities around which are, mm-hmm. have good schools and.
Well, for a lot of people, this Cambridge is an attractive place to be.
Yeah, but not in a salary you get paid as a starting scientist. You can't afford it.
Yeah, I guess that's.
They drive 2-3 hours. Yeah. They live in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Misery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how far along was Humira when you decided to retire?
So I'll tell you the Humira story.
So
we started working in Humira with Kat, and that was a 50-50 research collaboration. They wouldn't let phage display out of the house. So they did the phage display, but we did everything else. And, you know, we supervised the collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I asked a young German scientist, Jochen Salfeld, to lead the program. He had been hired by BASF before me. He was from he was a graduate student at the University of Heidelberg, which is in the BASF Gebiet. Ludwigshafen is close to Heidelberg. And that part of Germany is more or less run by BASF. Mm. You know, it's by far the largest employer. Mm. There's not a lot of other industry there. Mm-hmm. But he'd been a postdoc with Bill Hazeltine and was hired out of Dana-Farber into BASF Bioresearch.
Okay.
And he's a molecular biologist, so I asked him if he would be in charge of the recombinant antibody work, which was the best decision I've ever made. The guy's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I knew his supervisor was one of the co-founders of Biogen, well, the original scientific advisory board.
German guys.
There was one guy from Heidelberg.
I know. It's a
bacterial geneticist.
I can see his face.
He's gone now, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, shortly after I took the BASF job, I went to the university and had lunch with him and some other people I knew there. So I asked him, you know, what about this guy Salfeld? And there's another memorable conversation. He said, it's very simple. There's only one thing you have to know about Salfeld. What you ask him to do, he will do. That's it. Okay. And that turned out to be. So Jochen is now the head of biologics for AbbVie. He's been there forever. He's got 180 people in that group. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty much responsible for Humira from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
He still spends 30% of his time on Humira. Mm. From 1991, almost all patent litigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we worked with Kat, and it took a couple of years, but by brute force, we got phage display to work. They didn't have good libraries. But, you know, they improved along the way, so we got Humira to work. In the meanwhile, Mark Feldman gave this incredibly important talk at a Keystone meeting in 1993, where he talked about treating 20 patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis with what became Remicade, this failed Centocor anti-TNF chimeric antibody. Mm-hmm. And Dan Tracy, my head of immunology, was at the Keystone meeting. He called me up, actually, after the talk. He was so excited. He said, we have the indication. Nothing's ever worked. I don't know if you know about that paper. It's a paper in Lancet.
Mm, no. I'll have to look it up. Yeah.
Mark Feldman is the senior author, and Tiny Miney, who was the head of the Kennedy Institute in London. They treated 20 patients, and 18 had a remarkably positive response. And Centocor jumped on it, Immunex jumped on it, we jumped on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we knew what to do. We got some clinical people vaguely interested within the company. And about a year later, we had a clinical candidate. We thought, put it into production. We had, you know, we'd already built up a production thing, so we made it in Worcester. And then had to get people in the company within Knoll to do clinical trials, which was difficult because there was no experience.
Doing biologics, or?
No experience in rheumatology. Mm-hmm. So Jochen Salfeld knew, I won't explain the details, but he knew there was one senior clinician who probably would jump on this because he was jealous of somebody else and was a real bull of a guy, and if he jumped on it, it probably would get get through. The problem was he was an oncologist and didn't know anything about arthritis. But between the two of them, they hired consultants, and they hired a guy who got fired by Roche, who was a good rheumatologist as well, plugged in with KOLs and delivered the clinical plan, so they got it in the clinic. And after a while, we convinced the U.S. company to be interested. It took a lot of discussions. They weren't interested in the beginning. And at that time, we had reorganized into kind of a therapeutic area organizational structure. It's a really good structure. So within each therapeutic area, there was an organization that went from marketing to early project selection. And everybody worked together, and you had one budget. So we had a immunology oncology therapeutic area that I co-led with a very good marketing guy. And in 95, I think we had a key meeting where we pitched our overall budget, including a lot of money to take what is now called Humira into phase two, I think, or to continue phase two. And this committee, in its wisdom, said, no, we won't give you any more money. You have a budget for your therapeutic area. It's your problem. Figure out how to pay for it. So we went out of the room, and we came back and told them we were exiting oncology. We were shutting down the therapeutic area.
And put all, so you could put all your money into clinical trials.
And other than that, we sold the pipeline for $65 million to Dan Van Hoff's company in Texas, which then got bought by Genzyme. But we got $65 million to put into the Humira.
And you could do that. There was, you, that was, yeah?
Yeah.
Did that make any waves, or?
No. It was, I had fought to have, I had my own BD group, in a little group, two people in Worcester. So they cut the deal. And I had my own legal team.
So that funded phase two?
Well, funded it. It helped. We had to fire people and move people around. So that sort of went on. And towards the end of the 90s, the 97, 98, I was increasingly concerned that we wouldn't be able to market Humira, because the Centocor drug had been approved, Enbrel was about to be approved, and we had little Knoll Pharmaceutical Company in New Jersey, which was not the world's finest pharma marketing company. And they wanted to keep it, they wanted to market it. Of course, it would be a potential big drug, or at least significant drug.
Right.
I don't think they ever thought it would be a huge drug. And I didn't agree with that. I didn't think that was suitable. I thought we should partner it. So I tried several times to convince senior management to partner it. First time they agreed to do an exercise, the partnering was run out of the market, sales and marketing company in New Jersey. And they reported back that there wasn't really much interest, which I knew wasn't true. They didn't want to share it. So some years later, we pushed again, got approval to look for a partner, but I had learned my way a little bit around the company and had gotten approval that we would run it out of the research site in Worcester. And the condition was that we had to change the reporting structure of the local BD person to report to the BD person in Germany, which is fine. The guy in Germany was this fine guy. So they ran a partnering exercise. This is 99, I guess. Drug was in phase three. And we made a list of who was good in rheumatology, who to talk to. And Pfizer had already been pushing us. They were interested. And I was amazed. It was a feeding frenzy. You know, I didn't appreciate the value of a ME3. You know, there's nothing better for a big pharma company than an advantage ME3 that's 2 years behind, because you know it's going to work. You know, you can calculate its value, and then it's up to your marketing muscle and your strategy. But you know, it's not like investing in something novel in phase three. So it's execution risk.
Yeah, but you can get surprises in phase three.
Right? Yeah, well, of course, but you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing without. But compared to something in phase three that's a novel mechanism, mm-hmm. you know, it's actually prioritized over that. At least it was then. You know, there's always mm-hmm. trends. So we started this partnering campaign, mm-hmm. and a lot of companies wanted it. We had the pleasure of turning down Genentech.
Yeah, you know, that was a pleasure.
Well, they refused to give us a Kabili license. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The terms for giving us a Kabili license was the drug. Mm. So we told them no, and also they didn't have anything to offer in rheumatology. Mm-hmm. They had no sales force. Mm-hmm. So we ended up cutting a deal with Eli Lilly. What are you looking
at? Well, I'm just looking through my notes to see if I have notes on who else, but you mentioned Pfizer.
That wasn't public at the time.
Uh-huh, okay.
No, none of this is public.
But yeah.
It's long enough. So
sure.
What I'm not disclosing is not public, wasn't public information. Mm-hmm. So Pfizer was very interested but backed out because this is before they had bought Searle. They had a deal with Searle about Celebrex, which was their top drug. And rather late in the day, their legal department told them they couldn't enter into a deal with BSF for an anti-TNF because there was a non-compete in their Celebrex contract defined by therapeutic area and included anti-inflammatories. Hmm. So, their lawyers, they just thought it would be a mess. Mm-hmm. So they politely backed out. Mm-hmm. And we really liked Lilly. They would be, they're a really strong biologics company and good people. You know, while we were negotiating the deal, the teams were coming together and people liked each other. And, they really had something, they knew something about.
Who were you talking to? Who were the individuals?
Mm-hmm. Don't remember now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't handling the negotiations. That was BD person. Mm-hmm. So we actually got a ready-to-execute contract, and that would have been the biggest pharma deal ever done. They offered $200 million up front for basically a Celebrex deal for co-promotion in the U.S. for 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's all they would have gotten out of it.
So
they were very excited to do that, but to be careful about how much I can disclose here. But at the same time, in parallel, I was working on a project to spin out my unit and merge it with another leading U.S. biotech company.
It starts with an A. Huh?
Oh, sorry?
A biotech company.
Biotech company.
Oh, okay. And that's what you can't disclose?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to puzzle out who it is.
Yeah. It was, it was a Millennium. But this is, or you can look at who had $1 billion at the time. Mm-hmm. This is the time when, the biotech industry was
what
booming.
Year this is?
This is the bubble.
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh.
This is when, people were, raising billions of dollars. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or at least $1 billion. And we're looking for products. Mm-hmm. You can figure it out. Look who else worked with Kat. And,
okay, we'll get it. Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been trying to convince senior management at BSF, not the BSF pharma things, but my protector within BSF was a guy named Egert Foscherau, who had been my boss in the U.S. The organization of BSF BioResearch was rather complicated because of the corporate structure of BSF worldwide. So legally, we were a subsidiary of BSF North America. Not of the farm. We weren't owned by the pharma company. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're owned by the North American chemical company.
Yeah.
So formally, I reported to the head of life sciences in the North American division of BSF, to whom was also responsible the head of the sales and marketing company. And this guy was Egert Foscherau, who then became the head of BSF in North America. And then went back to Germany and became the number two in BSF on the executive board.
So
brilliant, 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 wonderful guy. And he, in the various political problems within the company, he was always protecting his Worcester site, mm-hmm. which he thought was very important for the company. Mm-hmm. And he and I had a good relationship. And I had been trying to convince him to do this spin-out. I hadn't told the other people in the farm division. Nobody else knew about it. Mm-hmm. And the major motivation was the people, you know, because all these guys, all the biotech companies had stock. And nobody knew about us. We had this, because we were, Wall Street had no interest, so there's no reason to write about us. Mm-hmm. We had a really good group, 400 people, production, good research, small molecule, large molecule. Nobody had any stock. I said they had one share. BSF went to the New York Stock Exchange to give everybody one share of stock. Imagine how motivating that was. I still have it. What do you do with what do you do with one share of stock? So I thought if we could merge with a biotech company, everybody could get some shares and maybe they'd be rewarded like the Millennium people mm-hmm. would be. It may be naive, but you know, I thought it was my job to try. Mm-hmm. So when I had this Eli Lilly contract on my desk, I wouldn't have signed, I guess I would have co-signed it, but it wasn't my decision. Mm-hmm. It would be through the management of the BSF Pharma division. I said, well, I better talk to Eggert, because you know, if we give away the asset, there's nothing to merge. So I called him up and told him about this. And he said, how come I don't know you're partnering this thing? Nobody ever told me.
He didn't know you hadn't?
No, he was my boss's boss's boss. Mm-hmm. So he was the chemical company, the parent company yeah, leadership. Yeah. So the head of BSF Pharma reported to him, and my boss reported to that guy.
Yeah. And just too many layers to remove.
Well, it turned out he'd just been busy. He'd be just been buying the agricultural business of American Home Products. So mm-hmm. he'd been very busy.
Sure.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, he says, come over and have lunch tomorrow. So I drop what I'm doing, go to the airport, get on the plane, go and have lunch, and the BSF executive board, they get rather well treated by the company. They have a wing on the company, dining common, there's just dining rooms for the executive people. And we have lunch in this octagonal room, it's all mirrors all around, one table in the middle, elegantly set up, just me and Eggert, waitresses just for us, sort of an elegant lunch. They cook very well there. And he asked me, you know, what's up? You know, what's with this? So I explained the whole Lilly deal. And he said, you know, I've been trying to sell this division for 3 years. He used an expletive, which I won't mention, because there have been all these rumors that we're aware of that BSF was getting out of pharma. Never confirmed, but you know, there were all these rumors. You think this must be something there. Mm-hmm. He confirmed that, in fact, they'd been trying to, they had decided they wouldn't continue in pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm. And you hadn't known about this?
I just knew it was in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And he said that now I realize I've been making a mistake. I've been trying to sell a mid-size German pharma company. I'm going to sell an American company with a potential blockbuster that happens to have 10,000 employees mm-hmm. and a pipeline in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, would you tell those nice people in Indianapolis that the terms are a little different? Around 10 billion, they can have the division.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to see it. So he was the guy who would have to sign this contract. I'm going to sign it. And then he says, you'll be called by some investment bankers in London next week. Please dedicate the next 6 months to the sale of this division.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how Humira got made, in that Lilly, unfortunately, was in the middle of their antidepressant had just come off patent, and they were anticipating a decline in sales, and they couldn't
afford it.
Well, I've talked to some of the Lilly people since then, and they really regret that they hadn't figured out a way.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, power of hindsight, who would have known?
Yeah.
So we spent 6 months in London with the executive team from,
again, talking to a lot of different people.
Yeah, a lot of different people, and the company that came in last was Jeff Lyden leading Abbott. And Jeff is something, I didn't remember I knew him, but I knew him, he'd been a consultant for GI about something, I'd forgotten that.
So he was a business guy, right?
No, Jeff Lyden's a scientist.
Oh.
Abbott history. So Abbott, Jeff Leiden was the chairman of cardiology at University of Chicago Medical School, although his research field was T-cell transcription factors. He's a Jack Strominger postdoc at Harvard. So maybe I met him when he was at Harvard. I don't know. No, I couldn't admit it. He's younger than I am. So he had been added to the Abbott board in the late 90s. You know, the pharma companies like to have a senior clinical person. And he'd been asked by Miles White, who had just become CEO of Abbott, maybe 98, 99, something like that, to do a board-level review of R&D because they hadn't been productive, you know, the usual problem. So Jeff had done that, and Miles liked the report a lot and insisted that Jeff join Abbott to execute his plans. So he convinced him. In the meantime, Leiden had moved to a position at the Harvard School of Public Health. He was Ed Haber's successor, who was some famous chair at the medical school. So Jeff took the plunge. He was 40, I think. He'd never run. I think he started and sold a small biotech company. Never run anything except his lab. He took over at Abbott, but he wouldn't take the job to be head of R&D. He would only take it if he had the division. So he went from professorship to running Abbott Pharmaceutical Division. And his first priority in his plan was a significant acquisition. They needed a product. And he asked the BD people to come up with a really good acquisition candidate. And it turned out that they had been outbid by J&J to buy Centocor a year and a half before to get Remicade. And the same guy who led that project knew about D2E7. So they told Jeff, you know, you got to go out and get this German company. So Jeff came in with a mission. They made the, highest bid. And he made it possible. So he was just fantastic because he'd just come into the job. He could do whatever he wanted. And he told, you know, the deal with me is, he said, you know, you're going to be ring-fenced. You know, don't look at what we're going to do to the rest of BSF Pharma. You know, we can't keep it all. But he promised that the Worcester site would be doubled, and that I would report to him. I wouldn't be integrated into the their R&D hierarchy, and that he would make what was called D2E7 at the time, a successful drug. That was wonderful. I mean, they just put everything on it. They just made such a big push. I mean, more resources.
Did they think it was going to be bigger than you thought it was going to be? I mean, did anybody have an idea?
Yeah, I thought they thought it, would be big. I mean, we were predicting $600 million peak sales, something like that. But when we, so I stayed on, I guess, about a year and a half until the BLA was filed. But they had really beefed up the whole effort. I mean, Jeff told everyone, you know, that Abbott is based on this drug being approved, and I don't want to take any chance. You know, everything has to be done exactly the right way. You know, we need resources. And everybody in Chicago just jumped on board. These people stopped what they were doing, and they joined the team. We had 629 people on the project team when the BLA was filed, which is quite a big push.
Yeah.
And they had no immunology marketing. They built the whole thing from scratch. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's an interesting story in itself. And you thought that at that time your job is done?
No, actually, I liked working with Jeff a lot, and he was very inclusive. He brought me into his executive team, which was, so I was on the executive team that ran the Abbott Pharma business, not just R&D. That was really interesting. But he expected me to run the Worcester site, and that was growing. We had to hire a lot of people and worry about them. Most people don't know Humira was made for the first 5 years in Worcester. It's probably the most valuable single product ever made in Massachusetts. If you look at the sales price of that, it was probably $1 billion a year worth of Humira.
And you had a great manufacturing site thanks to BASF. Right?
Yeah, and this guy Peter Moesta, who was running it, who was just a gem. He sort of reported to me for a while, but you know, I didn't have much impact. I would just listen to him and shake my head and say, yeah, you're probably doing the right thing. He, by the way, now runs manufacturing for BMS.
Mm-hmm.
He retired after 30 years at age 56 and switched companies. So they just did a great job of launching it. But oh, I'm saying, well, why I retired? So the job was just undoable because I was getting involved in all the Abbott-wide things in Chicago, and Jeff really wanted me to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And by phone, if you're the only person on the phone, everybody knows each other, you know,
it
doesn't work. So I was flying back and forth to Chicago, and before that, for 10 years, I've been flying to Germany, New Jersey, and doing a lot of traveling. And it was stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I would hire somebody to run the Worcester site. I would stay based there, but hire someone under me. We did a search and realized there wasn't room in the job description for the quality of person I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that the only way to...
just to get out of the way.
The only way was to get out of the way.
Yeah.
And so I went and talked with Jeff and said, look, I really want to retire. And I promise I'll get somebody who's 10 years younger and 10 times better. He said, okay, you do that. And we were lucky enough that I knew through old academic connections about this guy, Sandro Arrufo at BMS. He was about to become the head of discovery at BMS. And I never met him, but I knew his PhD daddy, who thought he was the finest thing ever. And he'd gone directly from his PhD work into BMS and worked his way up, and he was about to become head of discovery at age 38 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a headhunter call up Sandro, and he indeed was movable.
Mm-hmm.
He's now unfortunately gone. Mm. He did very well with Abbott and then got a gut cancer and died very young.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have the whole story.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for taking the time. You've done a lot of interesting stuff since. Maybe another time we could just...
Yeah, it goes on, but...
Right. Yeah?
Yeah.
Good for now, and maybe we can talk again sometime.
Yeah, get an old guy talking, you know, hear all the stories.
So, well, these are important stories and fascinating, too.
Yeah.
And we need to get them from the source.
Yeah. And BSF did well with their divestment. So people criticized them.
How much, what was the price?
6.8 or 6.9 billion. Which was a number BSF was happy with. In retrospect, it's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Humira will do 13.2 billion this year.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and I think there's a lot of German press that criticizes BSF for getting out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we all know we couldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't be that drug. But then even more importantly, this year when I got my... notice to attend the annual BSF shareholders meeting because of my one share of BSF stock. I went online and looked to see the performance of BSF since the sale of the pharma division. It's quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
They've outperformed the S&P by twofold. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. They're doing fine.
How can you criticize them?
Right. Very good.
Anything more than enough. No.
Oh, yeah.
I could talk forever.
Okay, thanks.
So Jochen Salford and I would like to write a book about Humira at some point, but as long as he's still at Abbott, we can't do that. The lawyers won't allow it.
How long is he planning to stay?
No, I'll be there a while.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very interested in history. He's written a history of his family. But there's so much litigation pending, the lawyers, quite correctly, they don't want anything.
Sure, no.
Anything more written. Every document has been in so many trials now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be doable. I mean, if it's been in a trial, it's a lot of that stuff has to be publicly accessible.
Oh, no, everything that is written down is public, but they would be worried about, you know, something else. You know, I sympathize with them. You know, it's
There are ways to write those stories.
It's a dream. Someday it should be Because I think most big drugs have a similar story. You know, any enterprise that takes years, it has big teams. You know, they get killed, they get born again, they have ups and downs. And what pharma management doesn't appreciate enough is that it's always keep people, you know, keep things going.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, this guy Saulfeld, you know, it would have.
Yeah. Well, I think the way to write that book would be to get all those key people and interview all of them.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we can help you with that. That's what we do. You know, we can get the.
I talked to him about that. I just saw him a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's worried until. There's still some big litigation undecided.
Mm-hmm. What are the issues?
Oh. Current one, there's an ongoing suit between it's AbbVie suing J&J for their Humira ripoff. They have a fully human anti-TNF as a successor to Remicade, which literally infringes a Saulfeld patent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in final appeal.
Who's appealing? They're appealing?
I haven't followed the details. I'll know this week. I've got to be a witness in it, but I haven't followed them.
Mm-hmm. Antibodies are kind of tricky, right? Because they're so complex. What's the patent on? Is it on the antibody? Is it process?
No, the patent, the case law about how to interpret claims in antibody patents is evolving, and a lot of the case law is based on Humira related. Litigation.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting story too.
Yeah, and what surprised me is that it's already been decided that the J&J product literally infringes, because the claim is a human antibody against human TNF alpha with an affinity of something or better. And mm-hmm. the something is minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And the J&J drug is a human antibody against TNF, so it literally infringes. But I wasn't aware that there's been case law that narrows these claims so that you actually have to demonstrate something more like small molecule patents. You have to demonstrate structural relatedness. So this case is about is there
different antigens or
no between the two antibodies? The two antibodies have to be structurally similar, which makes no scientific sense. So I'm not an expert in this.
Yeah,
but you know, in small molecule drug patents, the patent court is always trying to limit the scope to allow other invention to the you have to describe the molecules you're covering.
Mm-hmm.
And with antibodies, they've never required that, because any scientists know that two antibodies don't really have to be too structurally related, because you don't look at the structure when you make them. You know, immunize a mouse or
mm-hmm.
immunize an aptogenics mouse, and you look at something by functional criteria. You mm-hmm. don't look at the structure. There's no inventiveness in looking at the structure. But the courts are not looking at it that way at the moment.
Hmm, that's interesting.
But I think it's going to be a key.
Well, I think it's going to turn out that biochemistry will win the day, because at least for a small target like TNF, where there's only a certain domain on the surface of TNF where a neutralizing antibody can work, so that puts structural constraints on the antibody. So even if the scientists making the antibodies hadn't thought about the structure of the antibody, natural selection probably has dictated certain structural similarities.
Mm-hmm. Well, how well do they know the structure?
Well, they know the structure now. They've done the structure, but that was done
mm-hmm.
years after it was approved.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lawyers find it interesting.
It's interesting because of the consequences, too, right? The way they decide and what it means going forward. Interesting for historians and policy people and so on.
So are you a science historian? Is that what you're
doing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is great stories.
Yeah.
And what we try to do is improve public understandings, tell the stories in a way that we can reach people. People should know about this stuff. And they're also just the great stories.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, I left out one thing, one story, which maybe I shouldn't say, but I probably will.
Okay.
So I mentioned that my leaving GI wasn't exactly pleasant.
Right.
And of course, you know, if you're an R&D manager, you know, you're always a little bit uncertain about whether you made a contribution. You know, because your job is empowering other people.
Yeah.
You know, at GI had a lot of great scientists.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you guys published the Factor VIII story at GI.
Right.
I wasn't mentioned.
No, that's right.
You know, that was painful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, we were, we hadn't talked to you.
Yeah, I know. No, I understood that. Yeah. But those sort of things, you know, you kind of wonder. It might be true, you know, because you talk to Jay. You know, Jay thinks he didn't need any managing. Jay Toole, he didn't need any managing. You know.
Well,
Anyway, so I don't have to revisit that. But objectively, as a scientist, you only know if something is true if you can reproduce it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I was a graduate student, I had the great privilege of being hired as an extra on the filming of the Steve McQueen version of the Thomas Crown Affair. You ever see that film?
Yeah.
It's a great Steve McQueen, Faye Dunaway film.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 3 weekends making a little money being an extra.
Mm-hmm.
And hanging out with Steve McQueen occasionally. And then I saw the movie, which, you know, you couldn't tell if you're an extra what they're making. And in the beginning of the film, it's a golf scene, and the McQueen character sinks a very, very long putt. And the guy he's playing against is pissed off and hands over a big pile of cash. They were clearly paying for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And McQueen looks at him, and this guy's very upset. And McQueen takes the money, gives it back to him, and says, "I'll do it again." And I've always thought about that. So BSF Bio Research was my second putt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because even then, you know, I know that, like, Jochen Salfeld built Humira. And, I, you know, it's hard to say, you know, not in a patent. You don't really know what you're doing maybe this is egotistical to talk about, but.
No, I don't think so.
And having a chance to do another GI from scratch up to exit, I mean, that's why I feel good about that. You know, I feel that, you know, that I may actually, a significant probability I contributed.
Yeah, and of course. And this is these are important things. And think of, what's the counterfactual? If you hadn't been there doing X, Y, and Z along the way, you know, would somebody else have done it? Maybe, but of course, we don't know. Yeah.
We don't know.
But those things had to be done, and you did them.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very sorry that we left you out of the Factor VIII story.
Well, I'm sure that had to do with the people you talked to.
Well, we just... and we didn't really talk about a management angle, and I forget the story precisely, but we talked about...
The people who did what? No, it was factually correct.
Yeah.
But there was a puppeteer behind the...
Yeah, right. Well, we didn't have that role in there. This is why it's important to talk to everybody. We're trying to do it. And that's why I say, if you write the Humira book, you know, identify the people, as many of the key people as you can. We're trying to do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I'm not criticizing you about that story, but...
Mm-hmm.
It was good otherwise.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful thing that you're doing this.
It's fun, too.
Before it all gets forgotten, people die. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Are you going to do one about George Rathman? Have you done one about George Rathman?
We've got oral histories. We didn't do oral history with George, but Sally Smith Hughes at Berkeley